Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, the best algae for biodiesel, the biological basis of the thalidomide effect, and a new kind of computer chip that promises to work in the same way as the nerve cells in your brain. Plus, we'll also hear about a new centre to catalyse progress in computational chemistry.
If we're able to advance to the point that when this project is over, we could sit down, design a catalyst from first principles, go to the lab, make a catalyst that looked exactly like that with atomic level precision, then take that catalyst and then test it and it actually does what we want to do and we're able to understand it completely, that would be success.
Jerry Spivey, and he'll be with us later in the programme. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and also in this, the April edition of the Chemistry World Podcast, are Anna Lucock, Phil Broadwith and Matt Wilkinson.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First up this month, using very small things to solve a big environmental problem. Anna, tell us about algae.
So algae is being touted as the future's hot new source for environmentally friendly fuel, but it's very tricky to find out exactly which strains will be the best to pursue to develop future of biodiesel.
You're saying that quite literally you have little algal cells. They make oily particles that we could extract and turn into something to run a car on.
Yep, absolutely. So microalgae contain very high levels of lipids and oils that are of real interest for people trying to hunt down the next sustainable fuel source. Unfortunately, not all those lipids are created equal. The people trying to develop these fuels are after one particular kind rather than others. It's only the fatty acids within those algal lipids that can be converted to biodiesel, and there are different kinds of those. So if we can pinpoint those strains that have the best lipid profile, we can develop them into the future of biodiesel.
Is that difficult to do then?
It's very time-consuming. It's excruciatingly slow to do the wet chemistry that's needed for a single strain to work out if it has a good profile. So what this group led by Al Darzins at the National Renewable Energy Lab in the US have done is trying to work out a new system that will mean that analysing those strains will take a matter of minutes rather than a matter of weeks.
Which sounds fantastic. How does it work?
So it does involve a bit of prep to begin with. Essentially, what they have to do is create a kind of model, a library, to be able to compare the future unknown strains to. So that involves doing a lot of wet chemistry. The preliminary work has involved spiking algal biomass with various different lipids and oils. And then what they do is do the wet chemistry on those. And then they combine it with a near-infrared spectroscopy technique because different lipids have very specific spectra. So they can combine those two sets of results into one data set. And then in the future, when you have an unknown algae, you do the near-infrared spectroscopy on it, get the spectra, compare it to the model, and you'll be able to get an idea of the various profiles of the lipids within that algae to decide whether you should pursue it.
So it gives you the kind of gold standard of what's the right profile I'm looking for to compare against the algae. You pick those ones and what presumably you enrich for that particular strain and then you develop those.
Yeah, it means you can focus right down because, for example, Al Darzins' group have hundreds and hundreds of strains that they need to pick to take forward for future research. Doing the wet chemistry on that and the traditional techniques would take months and months and months. This way they can do a single strain in a matter of minutes, they can get through all those, whittle it down to the most promising strains to take forward to the next step of research where they can really dig down and find out whether they'll be good for biodiesel.
So put some algae in your tank. Matt, totally changing direction now, back to a drug 1953-ish?
Yes, Chris. Thalidomide was originally launched onto the market in the early 1950s as a sedative, and it was widely used to help morning sickness in pregnant women. Unfortunately, it caused some terrible side effects in the fetuses of the unborn babies, causing the limbs not to grow properly.
And that obviously led to it being withdrawn, presumably.
Yes, it did, Chris. But interest didn't stop there in the drug, because some years later it was found that it was a very potent anti-leprosy agent, and it's also been found to have very good anti-cancer properties in some cancers.
So we'd like to use it, but obviously mitigate or minimise the risk of the problem that occurred in the 1950s with the birth defects happening again.
Exactly. I mean, the problem with the drug itself was that it could racemize in the body, and one enantiomer of the drug was active and didn't cause problems, the other did. And there's no way to stop that conversion from happening. But one thing that drug discovery researchers would like to know is how to stop those side effects from occurring in any potential new drug that might act in a similar way. So what Takumi Ito of the Tokyo Institute of Technology has done is immobilised the thalidomide onto magnetic particles and then exposed that to cell extracts from developing embryos, and found that the drug actually binds very, very strongly to a protein called cereblon.
Ah, right. So bypassing the cell extracts or lysates over these immobilised drug particles, you can then see what it locks onto, and that informs your knowledge of what the target probably is for those abnormal effects in the body.
Yes, Chris. But they found that this protein cereblon, that I believe has been implicated in limb growth in the past anyway, bound particularly strongly to the drug. And then to prove that that was the target or the off target for the drug that caused the side effects, they genetically modified chicks and zebrafish so that they didn't express the protein in question. And they found that they had very, very similar birth defects to embryos that were exposed to thalidomide.
Which sounds convincing, doesn't it?
It does. But then they went a step further and very carefully modified the protein itself, or modified the animals themselves, so that they would create a version of cereblon that would have all the normal functions of the protein but just wouldn't bind to thalidomide. And found that even when exposed to thalidomide, those animals developed into perfectly normal embryos and beyond.
And so, as you say, now that's been identified, it should be possible to make sure that future drug molecules that can have many of the beneficial effects of thalidomide won't have that negative side effect.
Yes, it should lead to a new test that all drugs could be tested against to ensure that no drug with a teratogenic effects are ever launched onto the market again.
An elegant piece of work. Thank you, Matt. When the UK government banned the 100-watt filament light bulb last year, there were riots. Well, OK, not quite, but people were very upset. The energy-saving alternatives, they said, just weren't lighting their fires or their houses. So why should we switch? And will the LED lighting that's coming up in future prove a bit more popular? Nadaraja Narendran.
What we are faced with right now is a demand for energy. And all around the world, people are looking at energy-efficient technologies, especially for lighting. In addition to that, we are also facing legislations to remove the incandescent lamps out of the market. So therefore, what consumers are going to be left with are the options of having either CFL, compact fluorescent lamps, or light-emitting diodes. Now, compact fluorescent lamps, we have had them for a number of years, over 20 years or so. LEDs are new. However, they have much more potential to save greater amount of energy, in fact, maybe 2 to 3 times more than what a compact fluorescent lamp can offer.
Well, let's pick up on that then. Could you give us some numbers? How much better is an LED rig than, say, a compact fluorescent compared with an incandescent bulb?
The metric we use to quantify energy is the luminous efficacy, which is given in lumens per watt. Lumens is the flux that comes out of the lamp per electrical watt. So the common incandescent lamp we use in our homes at best would be at about 15 lumens per watt. Compared to that, a compact fluorescent lamp is at about 60 lumens per watt. Now remember, these are the highest end of the performance I'm talking about, but in general what we may get in our stores may be much lower. But just for comparison, so 15 lumens per watt for incandescent, 60 for compact fluorescent lamps, which is about 4 times. Now, LEDs right now, they are at around, say, 100 lumens per watt. They've already exceeded the compact fluorescent lamp. But the ultimate goal is to get to 200 lumens per watt by 2020. What you would see is that the LEDs would be at least 2 to 3 times more efficient than the compact fluorescent lamp.
Efficiency is one thing, but if your lamp can only consume energy at the rate of 1 watt, it's not going to produce very much light, even if it's very efficient at doing so. Whereas a street lamp, whilst grossly inefficient, can still nonetheless be very powerful and illuminate a large area. So are we in a position to really take advantage of this amazing efficiency of the LED yet?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The question is not about what. The question is about the lumens, which means amount of light. So to give you an example, say one LED, a single LED may produce 100 lumens, whereas discharge lamps and street lamps may produce, say, 10,000 lumens. What that means is we may have to put many more LEDs in an array. So the lighting fixtures are going to be composed of many LEDs put together rather than a single LED.
Well, let's look then at this question of sort of fixtures and fittings, because one of the biggest complaints when people put light bulbs of the next generation, at the moment compact fluorescents, into their homes is they don't like the kind of light they produce. And of course, because they've chosen all of the fixtures and fittings in their home to look good under incandescent bulbs, everything then looks quite harsh and garish, potentially, under the wrong sort of illumination. So are we in the position now with LEDs where we can produce that nice, warm, quite red-dominated glow that we all love?
Yes, but it's actually a myth. People think that compact fluorescent lamps cannot produce light similar to an incandescent lamp appearance. There are warm, white, compact fluorescent lamps. Now, what has happened in the marketplace is what's commonly available in our shops are the cool white. So that's what's more accessible to the consumer, and the consumers are generally not aware of the availability of other color temperatures. Coming to the LED, it has similar issues. Now, even in LEDs, you can buy cool white or warm white. So as far as the consumers are aware that they have the choice, they'll be satisfied.
But how do they compare in price terms? If I go and buy an incandescent, how much will that cost compared with an LED?
Almost nothing. The incandescent lamps right now, at least in the U.S., they are priced under a dollar. An equivalent LED lamp, probably you're talking about $40 to $60. One of the other issues with the LED technology is that it's not quite ready yet for the application we're talking about. The reason is the most commonly available LED light bulb replacements, they can match up to about 40 watts equivalent of an incandescent. But in our homes, we generally use 60 to 75 watts as the most common light source. 40 watts I use, but not as much. So therefore, if you really want to replace the incandescent lamps we're using in our homes, we may have to wait a year or so before we see those light bulbs in the market. And also, they'll be much more expensive. They'll be in the $20 to $40 range.
But then, of course, they last about 20 years, don't they, compared with about, in my view, 20 seconds in my house for a normal bulb?
They would last a long time. However, it's not about the LED, but it's about the product. It's the same LED designed and integrated into a light bulb will determine how long that light bulb will last. So if three different manufacturers use the same LED but have three different configurations, they may not all have the same life. So for the manufacturers who have not paid attention to thermal management, meaning controlling the heat, because heat is one of the enemies for the LED technology performance, they could be short-lived lamps. So this is another challenge for the consumer, is to understand which one lasts and which one does not.
If we did a cross-section of the market now, what proportion of the bulbs being sold are LED technology, and how do you see that changing in the next couple of years?
Okay, if you're strictly speaking about the incandescent lamp replacement, they're just appearing in the marketplace. If you want to see them more predominant in household use, it'll take another 3 to 5 years.
So pricey and coming soon, but you will save correspondingly more on your electricity bill. That was Nadaraja Narendran. He's the director of the Lighting Institute at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in New York. This is Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, 3D DNA nanoboxes for drug delivery, and the world's first hydrocarbon superconductors. But first, how scientists have managed to make computer chips work more like the connections between brain cells. Phil.
Yes, Chris. Well, conventional electronics and circuits are quite limited in their computing power because they're limited by what we can make out of silicon. We can make transistors and we can make them smaller and smaller and smaller to make better computers, but they're still just transistors. Something that people would like to do is use a device called a memristor, which is a combination of memory and resistor, so its resistance can change as you pass current across it. Acts a bit like a synapse that learns. So as a synapse in the brain fires multiple times, that strengthens the link between those two nerves, and you cement memory pathways and things like that, so the brain learns. If you can make circuits that work that way, you can drastically increase computing power on much smaller devices.
It sounds wonderful, but is that possible?
Well, memristors have been around for a little while. They've generally been made out of titanium dioxide or silicon that's had a little bit of silver ions added to it. And the problem with those kind of devices is that the silver kind of burrows its way through the silicon and makes permanent conducting channels. So once you've cemented a pathway, you can't then unlearn it.
So it's a bit like a memory that you've got stuck in your head, a song that won't go away, effectively.
Exactly, and you have a very abrupt change as well, so you get a big step up. You don't get so much fine control.
What's the solution then?
OK, so Wei Lu and his group at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor have made a memristor device by taking silicon and silver together and sputtering them onto a surface of a device. The technique that they've used is very easy to control, so they can change the distribution of silicon and silver as they build the device up. So you get a very good control of what's there.
Which stops you getting these burrowed down permanent connections of silver, presumably, the problem that was confounding the previous attempt.
Yeah, exactly. And because the silver can move around a little bit within the structure of the silicon, as you pass a voltage across it, you get a current, but some of the silver then moves. So the next time you pass that same voltage across the device, you get a bigger current, and the next time a bigger current. But if you then reverse the voltage, the silver can move back, and you can unlearn that connection.
And when you unlearn, does it just unlearn back to baseline, or does it unlearn incrementally in the same way as you learned incrementally with a strengthening building up? You can unlearn with a diminuendo, if you like, of the effect.
Exactly right, Chris. You've got control in both senses. It's a really big advance in this kind of memristor technology.
So if that was a computer, then you would have quite literally a two-dimensional way of doing processing, wouldn't you, rather than just on or off, which is what we're offered with present transistors and logic gates and things. You'd have on or off and how much on and how much off.
Exactly, Chris. And comparison with a brain is very apt, because what the group is actually doing is they're trying to make a computer that is the kind of hardware version of an animal's brain to give you that kind of processing power.
Well, certainly something to think about. Thank you, Phil. Now, Matt, on to something which is bodily related again, but probably going to be more therapeutic than computing. Tell us about these nanotubes.
Well, Chris, two groups at McGill University in Montreal, led by Hanadi Seaman and Gonzalo Cosa, have developed 3D nanotubes made out of DNA. And this is the first time that anybody has really made these 3D DNA nanotubes that can actually contain anything inside them.
So they're more like a nano box then?
Exactly. They probably would have called that had they thought of it. But what's really exciting about these is that rather than just being a nano box, because they're made of complementary strands of DNA, when they come into contact with a complementary strand, they can actually release their cargo. So you could imagine these being used to deliver drugs into the body when they came into contact with a diseased cell, or in biosensing applications where they could release a fluorescent sensor when they came into contact with an infecting microorganism.
Are these things easy to make? Is that feasible, or is this really, really difficult to get these little boxes, and do they self-assemble? How do they work?
Well, that's the beauty of using DNA to create a box, is that they can self-assemble. What's unusual about these is that they comprise of triangular DNA rungs in which each corner unit are rigid organic molecules. So these help to keep a certain structure. And then when the DNA does what it does best, which is binding to complementary strands and then unbinding, those structures are still somewhat kept in place and they're still kept as a strand of DNA, as a nano box as such. But it's just the size that changes.
Have they tested them in vivo yet? Because people are worried about these little tiny structures. There's this whole concept of nano hazard now, isn't there? With things on par with asbestos sort of sizes, like nanotubes are, being potentially a worry.
Now that is a big worry, obviously, and as yet they haven't gone into human beings or even they haven't gone into animals at all. What they have shown is that they can release gold nanoparticles from within these boxes by exposing them to complementary strands of DNA. So you can imagine the first examples of any real life application would actually be in biosensing applications. Further on down the line, if the safety of these things could be proven, then maybe you could get them actually being used to deliver drugs into the body in the future.
Thanks, Matt. Catalysts are one of the most important aspects of chemistry. They can make and break molecules in ways that otherwise would be almost impossible. But finding and designing new ones is really tricky because it takes a lot of theoretical work to come up with the chemical concept in the first place, and then there's the practical aspects of actually making and testing the results. These are all very different disciplines and they require different sets of skills. So Jerry Spivey from Louisiana State University has decided to tackle this problem head on.
Specifically, what we're trying to do is to develop a center in which people in three areas: computational catalysis, synthesis, and then those people who are working in the characterization and testing area, where they work together in teams that they probably would not otherwise work together.
So what are the big outstanding problems then in the field of catalysis? Because you've mentioned bringing people together in the right sort of way to get them talking together is one such problem. But what are the real things you need to get your teeth into here?
Some of the things that we really need to address are developing models of computational catalysis that are more representative of the actual working catalyst surface. For example, the models that use fundamental equations to solve the catalytic cycles using the solutions to the Schrodinger wave equation in methods that are called, for example, density functional theory or DFT. Many of those types of models have to make assumptions that do not represent what happens on a real catalyst. Many of those models, not all, but many of them have to assume that the catalyst surface doesn't change during the reaction. That's probably not what actually happens. In fact, we know it doesn't happen in certain cases.
So at the moment, there would be someone who would be sitting at a computer coming up with these strategies to do catalysis, but they wouldn't know the feasibility or the functionality or the wet chemistry. You're saying by bringing those people together with people who do know the answer to those questions, you can actually streamline the whole process.
That's right. And there are some examples in the literature of people who are making some nice advances in that direction. The trick is that even if we can identify computationally a catalytically ideal surface, and even if we could make it, we are then faced with the task of trying to characterize it. And by characterize it, I mean looking at the atomic level structure of that catalyst and being sure that every atom is in the right place and that no atoms are out of place. We're then faced with a further task of testing it and see if experimentally it carries out the reaction that we're interested in. So this center addresses that entire spectrum of activities. Just so that you realize the scope of this, we have 21 different investigators at 9 different institutions. The Department of Energy is providing $12.5 million over a 5-year period. The state of Louisiana is funding it at an additional $1 million over that 5 years.
But 5 years doesn't give you long, does it? With something of that kind of complexity, bringing all that expertise together to tackle these problems, it can take 5 years just to gather momentum. So have you got some kind of strategy to keep this thing going into the long term?
What we've got to do is make sure that we're organized in a way that encourages and reward teams to do two things. One of them is to get results as quickly as possible, but obviously we want to take our time and not rush into things, but do them in a scientifically logical way. But we also need to promote synergism between the investigators. The way that we've done that is to define 10 specific projects. In each project, we have computational people, synthesis people, characterization people. A given project is oriented toward a specific reaction on a specific set of catalysts and is staffed by people with each of those types of expertise.
Can you give us some examples of what those 12 projects are? What are you gunning for?
What we're trying to do is to use reactions that are simple enough to be modeled computationally. We're not interested, for example, in complicating the computational or the synthesis or testing aspects of the work by looking at overly complex reactions. One example that we're, just to illustrate that point, is a reaction that's been widely studied by a number of people, and that's the dry reforming of methane. It's the reaction of methane and CO2 to produce CO and hydrogen. So in that reaction, what we're trying to do is use a crystalline oxide. It's called a pyrochlore, but the point is that is a catalyst that can be relatively easily modeled because it's a crystalline material and not subject to the types of uncertainties that are involved when we have supported metal clusters on an oxide surface that can move around at reaction conditions, that can change their morphology and so forth. So we intentionally chose a crystalline material that's stable at the reaction conditions. We intentionally chose a simple reaction between two 1-carbon molecules. We are trying to use that reaction as a way of improving the tools that I've talked about. We're not interested in making a better catalyst for a reaction. What we're trying to do is understand the catalyst better.
And if you're successful and you get this platform that can do all these things, what do you think is the one catalyst that it would be really helpful for the whole world and not just the US to actually develop?
We're also looking at photocatalytic reactions involving the conversion of CO2 into methanol. That would be able to take and harvest visible light and make a liquid fuel, methanol in that case, from CO2. That's the type of reaction creating a lot of interest these days. It'd be hard for me to pinpoint one, but I think if we're able to advance the computational tools and the synthesis and characterization tools to the point that when this project is over, we could sit down and, at least for some reactions, design a catalyst from first principles at the desk, go to the lab, make a catalyst that looked exactly like that and nothing else with atomic level precision, then take that catalyst after we've made it, characterize it, and then test it, and it actually does what we want to do and nothing else. And that whole process is then seamless. Everything works and we're able to understand it completely. That would be success.
Jerry Spivey. To a world first now, and how scientists have turned hydrocarbons into superconductors. Anna.
Absolutely. Yoshihiro Kubuzono and colleagues at Yokohama University and other Japanese institutions have discovered the first superconducting material based on a molecule of hydrogen and carbon atoms. So superconductivity occurs when a material is cooled below a certain key transition temperature, at which pretty much all its electrical resistance disappears. So early research on these kind of materials tended to focus on metals, and the temperature tended to be around absolute zero, so pretty cold. So what these Japanese researchers have managed to do is create the first organic superconductor based on piscine, which is a simple aromatic molecule based on 5 benzene rings joined together edge to edge in a kind of zigzag formation. And once they dope it with an alkaline metal, it becomes a superconductor at a balmy 18 Kelvin, so about minus 250-something degrees C.
Positively sizzling. This presumably is in itself not a massive leap forward in terms of we're not going to use this molecule, but the actual proof of concept is important.
Absolutely. It's a relatively simple molecule for this for them to have achieved this in, and hopefully it'll stimulate lots of research in other similar molecules, either doping with potassium, which is what they used in this case, or doping with other metal atoms to see if they could potentially simulate a whole new class of superconductors.
Do we actually know what's going on when piscine becomes this superconductor? Why is it having this behaviour?
So we have an idea. So basically what the researchers did was pass potassium vapour over solid piscine, which absorbs the potassium atoms. Those atoms then donate electrons to the unoccupied pi electronic states, which provides the charge carriers needed for superconductivity.
I mean, that doesn't actually sound like rocket science. They actually know how it works. So it should be pretty easy now to start saying, well, why can't we do this with other molecules?
You think so? There's a lot of excitement every time a new superconducting material is discovered, but they tend to have focused on slightly different molecules. This is sort of the first step, big step forward in hydrocarbons. So hopefully it will stimulate a lot more research in these kind of materials.
Fantastic. You heard it here on the Chemistry World podcast, organics that turn supercritical, well, superconductors. Now, Phil, tell us, if you would, about how I can turn a T-shirt into a good defence against maybe a landmine, a bullet, or just my wife.
It might not stop a bullet, but a group of researchers at the University of South Carolina in the US have discovered that cotton is an ideal substrate for growing nanomaterials based on boron carbide, which is the third hardest material in the world.
Wow. Go on, tell us, how do they do this?
OK, so there's been a lot of interest in boron carbide for use in things like body armour. It's already used as plates built into sort of armoured vests because it's so hard. But those plates aren't very flexible. What we'd really like to do is have materials that are reinforced with that with the boron carbide to get the strength and toughness, but with maintaining some flexibility to make it more comfortable to wear. Problem being, when you try and make boron carbide nanowires to reinforce materials with, they all kind of clump together and you don't get any of the flexibility anymore.
So where does the cotton come in?
Okay, well, what Xiaodong Li and his group discovered was that, or decided was that they needed some kind of template to grow these boron carbide nanowires on. And they had the brainwave that cotton might be an ideal version for this. Cotton has a very porous surface. So what they did is they got a standard cotton T-shirt, cut some squares out of it, soaked those in a liquid that had boron powder and a nickel catalyst in. Then they chucked them in a tube furnace at 1100 degrees Celsius for a few hours under a flow of argon that stops the cotton from burning. And what happens is the cotton then pyrolyzes, it turns into a carbon fiber, and on the surface of that carbon fiber, where the boron was absorbed, you grow these little nanowires. It keeps the nanostructure and stops them all clumping together.
And what, you would then be able to stitch those fibres? They're flexible, you can move them around. What do you do with them?
You still have a piece of material. It's not a white T-shirt anymore, it's black. But you have this microstructure, it's much tougher than the cotton was, but it still retains its flexibility. It's also a very good sunscreen, so you could wear your T-shirt and not have to wear any sunscreen.
But applications-wise, beyond just sunscreens, you could see how this surface could be applied to various things to give protection.
So we're talking about developing composite materials. One of the things that that the group tried was to set layers of the boron carbide-covered cotton fabric in an epoxy resin. That made that epoxy much more tough, but also more flexible than the epoxy on its own. So you're seeing the effect of this reinforcement with the boron carbon fibres, but still retaining some flexibility.
Always important to be flexible. Thanks, Phil. And in fact, never more so than now, because you're going to need to warp your sense of humour for our Chemistry World Science Joke of the Month. So, Matt, please do the honours.
Right, well, this month's winning joke is this. Heisenberg is out for a drive in the countryside when he's stopped by a policeman. The policeman asked him, "Do you know how fast you were going, sir?" And Heisenberg replied, "No, but I know where I am."
Yes, very good, Matt. Well, that joke was sent in by Matt Evans from York University in the UK. And if you think you can do better, then send your entries to chemistryworld@rsc.org for a chance of winning the fabulous Chemistry World goodie bag. But if you're a little bit uncertain as to why that joke's funny, then check out the Heisenberg Uncertainty Principle on the web. There's plenty of answers there.
And sincere apologies to anyone who is still cringing. The email address to send in your complaints, sorry, jokes, is chemistryworld@rsc.org. We're back with more chemical shenanigans next month, but don't forget there's also our sister podcast called Chemistry in Its Element to keep you entertained in the meantime. The contributors this month were Phil Broadwith, Anna Lucock and Matt Wilkinson. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.